He had cried when his dad died after fighting grimly for his life for 3 days after a massive heart attack struck him. And those tears shed at 17 had been like these, burning, not wanting to come. It was more like bleeding than crying. But at 17, it was easier to cry, easier to bleed. When you were 17, you still expected to have to do your share of both. He stopped whimpering. He thought it was done. And then a low cry came out of him, a harsh, wavering sound, and he thought, was that me? God, was it me that made that sound? The tears began to slide down his cheeks. There was another harsh sound, then another. He gripped the convector grill and cried. 40 minutes later, he was sitting in Deering Oaks Park. He had called home and told Donna he would be late. She started to ask why and why he sounded so strange. He told her he would be home before dark. He told her to go ahead and feed Tad. Then he hung up before she could say anything else. Now he was sitting in the park. The tears had burned off most of the fear. What was left was an ugly slag of anger. That was the next level in this geological column of knowledge. But anger wasn't the right word. He was enraged. He was infuriated. It was as if he had been stung by something. A part of him had recognized that it would be dangerous for him to go home now. Dangerous for all three of them. It would be so pleasurable to hide the wreckage by making more. It would, let's face it, be so mindlessly pleasurable to punch her cheating face in. He was sitting beside the duck pond. On the other side, a spirited frisbee game was going on. He noticed that all four of the girls playing and two of the boys were on roller skates. Roller skates were big this summer. He saw a young girl in a tube top pushing a cart of pretzels, peanuts, and canned soft drinks. Her face was soft and fresh and innocent. One of the guys playing frisbee flipped her the disc. She caught it deftly and flipped it back. In the 60s, Vic thought, she would have been in a commune, diligently picking bugs off tomato plants. Now she was probably a member in good standing of the Small Business Administration. He and Roger used to come down here to eat their lunches sometimes. That had been in the first year. Then Roger noticed that, although the pond looked lovely, there was a faint but definite odor of putridity hanging around it. And the small house on the rock in the center of the pond was whitewashed, not with paint, but with gull shit. A few weeks later, Vic had noted a decaying rat floating amid the condoms and gum wrappers at the edge of the pond. He didn't think they had been back since then. The frisbee, a bright red, floated across the sky. The image that had provoked his anger kept recurring. He couldn't keep it away. It was as crude as his anonymous correspondent's choice of words had been, but he couldn't ditch it. He saw them screwing in his and Donna's bedroom, screwing in their bed. What he saw in this mind movie was every bit as explicit as one of those grainy, X-rated pictures you could see at the State Theater on Congress Street. She was groaning, sheened lightly with perspiration, beautiful, every muscle pulled taut. Her eyes had that hungry look they got when the sex was good, their color darker. He knew the expression. He knew the posture. He knew the sounds. He had thought he was the only one who did. Not even her mother and father would know about that. Then he would think of the man's penis, his cock, going up inside her. In the saddle. That phrase came and clanged in his mind idiotically, refusing to die away. He saw them screwing to a Gene Autry soundtrack. I'm back in the saddle again, out where a friend is a friend. It made him feel creepy. It made him feel outraged. It made him feel infuriated. The frisbee soared and came down. Vic followed its course. He had suspected something, yes, but suspecting was not like knowing. He knew that now, if nothing else. He could write an essay on the difference between suspecting and knowing. What made it doubly cruel was the fact that he had really begun to believe that the suspicions were groundless. And even if they weren't, what you didn't know couldn't hurt you. Wasn't that right? If a man is crossing a darkened room with a deep open hole in the middle of it, and if he passes within inches of it, he doesn't need to know he almost fell in. There is no need for fear, not if the lights are off. Well, he hadn't fallen in. He had been pushed. The question was, what was he going to do about it? The angry part of him, hurt, bruised, and bellowing, was not in the slightest inclined to be adult, to acknowledge that there were slips on one or both sides in a great many marriages. Fuck the penthouse forum or variations or whatever they're calling it these days. That's my wife we're talking about. She was screwing someone. Out where a friend is a friend. When my back was turned, when Tad was out of the house, the images began to unreel again. Crumpled sheets, straining bodies, soft sounds. Ugly phrases, terrible terms kept crowding up like a bunch of freaks looking at an accident. Nookie, hair pie, put the boots to her, shot my load. I don't fuck for fortune and I don't fuck for fame, but the way I fuck you, Mama, is a goddamn shame. My turtle in your mud. Bang for the gang. Stoop for the troops. Inside my wife, he thought, agonized, hands clenching. Inside my wife. But the angry, hurt Park acknowledged, grudgingly, that he couldn't go home and beat the hell out of Donna. He could, however, take Tad and go. Never mind the explanations. Let her try and stop him if she had cheek enough to do it. He didn't think she would. Take Tad, go to a motel, get a lawyer, cut the cord cleanly, and don't look back. But if he just grabbed Tad and took him to a motel, wouldn't the boy be frightened? Wouldn't he want an explanation? He was only 4, but that was old enough to know when something was badly, frighteningly wrong. Then there was the matter of the trip, Boston, New York, Cleveland. Vic didn't give a goddamn about the trip, not now. Old man Sharp and his kid could take a flying jump at the moon for all he cared. But he wasn't in it alone. He had a partner. The partner had a wife and 2 kids. Even now, hurting as badly as he was, Vic recognized his responsibility to at least go through the motions of trying to save the account, which was tantamount to trying to save AdWorks itself. And although he didn't want to ask it, there was another question. Exactly why did he want to take Tad and go without even hearing her side of the story? Because her sleeping around was wrecking Tad's morals? He didn't think so. It was because his mind had immediately seized upon the fact that the way to hurt her most surely and most deeply as he hurt right now, was through Tad. But did he want to turn his son into the emotional equivalent of a crowbar or a sledgehammer? He thought not. Other questions. The note. Think about the note for a minute. Not just what it said, not just those 6 lines of battery acid filth. Think about the fact of the note. Someone had just killed the goose that had been, pardon the pun, laying the golden eggs. Why had Donna's lover sent that note? Because the goose was no longer laying, of course. And the shadow man who had sent the note was mad as hell. Had Donna dumped the guy? He tried to see it any other way and couldn't. Stripped of its sudden, shocking force, wasn't, I enjoyed fucking the shit out of her, the classic dog-in-the-manger ploy? If you can't have it anymore, piss on it so no one else will want it either. Illogical, but so satisfying. The new, easier atmosphere at home fit into that reading as well. The almost palpable sense of relief Donna radiated. She had turned the shadow man out, and the shadow man had hit back at her husband with the anonymous note. Last question. Did it make any difference? He took the note out of his jacket pocket again and turned it over and over in his hands, not unfolding it. He watched the red frisbee float across the sky and wondered what the hell he was going to do. What the Christ is that? Joe Camber asked. Each word came out spaced, almost inflectionless. He stood in the doorway, looking at his wife. Charity was setting his place. She and Brett had already eaten. Joe had come in with a truck full of odds and ends, had begun to drive into the garage, and had seen what was waiting for him. It's a chainfall, she said. She had sent Brett over to play with his buddy Dave Bergeron for the evening. She didn't want him around if this went badly. Brett said you wanted one. A Jorgen chainfall, he said. Joe crossed the room. He was a thin man with a scrawny, strong physique, a big blade nose, and a quiet, agile way of walking. Now his green felt hat was tipped back on his head to show his receding hairline. There was a smudge of grease on his forehead. There was beer on his breath. His blue eyes were small and hard. He was a man who didn't like surprises. "You talk to me, Charity," he said.